Okay, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Noelle, and I'm an alcoholic.
Noelle.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And now I get the pleasure of introducing tonight's speaker. Our speaker is Sam E., and I have the honor of sponsoring her. And it's just amazing to watch in real life, in real time, all of the promises and the vision for you come true in someone's life. She works an amazing program. She's an amazing friend, and I know you'll be moved by what she has to say. So I give you Sam.
I was bring props. Dang, I was hoping for a little step stool too, but not that tall, but I'll talk loudly. I'm Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, gotta get the rest of my process. Keep track of my time. No, that's all right. Can you see me? Okay. I can see you all, so that's good. I'm an over-preparer and overachiever, so also, this is usually our bedtime, so if I start yawning and fall asleep, just please bear with me. Okay. March 19, 2012 is my sobriety date. And maybe, like you, I always felt different. And not because I was small, but because I seemed weird. Like, when we played Monopoly as kids, I always wanted to have Oriental Avenue and Baltic Avenue so I could build affordable housing for the poor people. And my sisters would get so mad at me, and then they would happily bleed me dry with all of their hotels on Park Place, and they're like, "You're not playing the game the right way." I also started kindergarten knowing how to read, which is really annoying for the teachers, so they gave me special privileges in the library. I could go check out anything I wanted, which wasn't true. It's anything except the Peanuts cartoon books, because that's what I wanted to read. They're like, "No, that's not educational enough." Like, "But they're in the library." No. My second grade teacher called my mother in for a conference because she thought there was something wrong with me, because when I was done with my schoolwork, I would go get a book to read instead of socializing. Of course, the teacher didn't tell her that she had tied another child to their chair for socializing too much during class, so she also called my mom again because two girls got into a fight over who was my best friend, and I refused to pick sides, and the teacher said, "You have to have only one best friend." I disagreed. I staged a sit-in to protest lunchroom rules for punishing the bad kids. I had a petition to try to get the lunchroom aides fired because they were mean to us. And there was no use calling my mother in, because she's where I learned it from. She's actually a political operative who ended up suing the Board of Education, which is why we had to go to Catholic school for grades 6 through 12. Where my mom said, "Study really hard, but don't follow the religion crap. Just don't." It was a little confusing. My mom also believed she was a witch. And that she could cast bad spells on people, which is why the music teacher fell off the ladder and broke both his legs a week after not giving my sister the solo, and also why my second grade teacher ended up with brain cancer and dying. I know. My mom was awesome. High school, I was in all honors classes, blah, 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 glee club, really annoying goody-two-shoes. I was a complete geek. And sophomore year, my mom made me dump all my friends because she didn't think they were good enough for me, and she hung up on everybody when they would call, and basically, embarrassed me a lot. So, but on the other hand, she had no problem letting my controlling boyfriend sit in my room and watch me sleep at night in my house. And when I finally broke up with him, she took his side. It's a little awkward. So, you would think this was a great recipe for drinking, but no, I totally didn't drink in high school, and I didn't drink in college either. And once I finally discovered alcohol, I thought, what the hell was wrong with me? I missed out. Oddly enough, though, I got left at the prom by my date because they wanted to go drinking, and I didn't. It was a little ironic. And I got thrown out of religion class for calling the priest a murderer waiting for a victim because he said he would drink and drive after Mass. Also ironic. So we moved from the Garden State to Atlanta in 1986 when my father was transferred here. I transferred from one college to another and never, ever, ever live at home while going to college. Just don't do it. It's bad. But I did. Instead of learning how to live on my own and be my own person, I turned my will and my life over to the care of my higher power mother, in a desperate bid to make up for my older sister, which we had lost the year before. But that's a story for another time. So I didn't drink in college. I was really anxious. I tried really hard. I studied really hard. But no matter what I did and how well I did it, I felt inadequate. And that got worse when my junior year, I came down with which was the first of many autoimmune diseases I would later be diagnosed with. Good times. My boyfriend at the time laughed at me. Not only was I too sensitive, too nice, too sweet, but now I was defective. And I did not break up with him until he joined the CIA. Be a jerk to me, that's fine. But you're going to be a spook? You've crossed the line. So I graduated, got a job for which I was wholly unqualified for as a political science economics double major. I taught nutrition to pregnant and parenting teenagers. Somebody thought I could do the job. It was really an eye-opening experience, full of heartbreak, beautiful babies, perseverance, and the drug dealers always made sure that they escorted me from my car to their girlfriends' houses because it was a bad neighborhood, and I was doing good for their moms and their sisters. So, yeah. That was where I first discovered my first addiction, which was starving myself, because that was a really great way to feel woozy and hazy. I don't know if any of you have ever done that. It's also a really great way to lose a lot of weight. But I felt dazed and confused all the time, and that felt comfortable. It kind of helped with the anxiety. But then I went to grad school twice. I got two master's degrees and all the awards the departments had to bestow. I was a superstar, but I felt completely inadequate. I still felt like I was no good. So I did what any normal person would do. I got into public policy work. So I started doing all this research and all these cool, hot issues, and I was, oh gosh, not quite 30 when I started appearing on television, radio, and newspapers. They were quoting me and my positions and my opinions. Our organization was really popular and well-respected, so if I said it, I was speaking for them. I must be awesome, too. And that helped a lot with the anxiety. No, it didn't. I still felt inadequate, and then I was selected for this leadership development program here in Metro Atlanta, and That was where I learned how to drink. With the big boys, with all the CEOs and these lawyers and all these high-powered rich people. And I felt like I had no reason being there. I was not wealthy, I wasn't tall, I wasn't a CEO, but somebody thought that I was a leader. So I did everything I could to learn everything I could about wine, because wine was sophisticated, and then I would be sophisticated if I drank wine. And I really liked the fuzzy, fizzy feeling that alcohol gave me, a lot. So I felt like I belonged. I felt like I could relax enough and talk to these people, and maybe they wouldn't notice I was the poor, short kid who really didn't belong there, no matter what my resume said. And I got to talk to these people, and ironically, one of the people in my class turned out to be the guy who dated my older sister in high school. And he remembered my crazy mom and our crazy family and why he had stopped dating my sister in high school. But he went on to become really rich, and his father's name is on a lot of businesses here in town, which made me feel really insecure again, so I got drunk. But my class members thought I belonged there because they voted me the class angel for having the biggest heart and basically being the total wuss, because I cried all the time about, oh my gosh, this is such a horrible thing, and oh my gosh, what about this? And I wasn't always drunk when I did the crying, but it was. But things took off from there. My anxiety and feelings of inferiority grew along with my list of successes and responsibilities, and wine was the magic elixir. A few glasses of wine and I'd feel confident. So I organized an event with the new mayor, and she and 250 people serenaded me on my birthday. I remembered it because I wasn't completely drunk, but I wasn't completely sober either. I chaired a committee that organized a really successful fundraiser, so our group went out to celebrate afterwards, and five of us drank $500 worth of wine. I didn't pay for it that time. And they proclaimed me truly arrived and one of them. And if by one of them they meant they drove home with one eye open, trying to find the house, stumbled in just fast enough to throw up all the wine, then yes, I was one of them. I don't think that's what they did, but that's what I did. So I did a lot more successful things. I was in charge of a big program at a big university. I got to be a big shot with this leadership program. But I still didn't feel like I belonged. And thank goodness there was a lot of free-flowing wine and beer at all these events. If you go into nonprofit work, it's a great place to drink, because they always have all these fundraisers with free wine and free beer, because that'll loosen you up and loosen your wallet so you'll spend more. So I got to drink a lot of free wine and beer. I did a lot of good things. I still didn't feel good, but I got good at dating, or rather getting attention. Not from the successful guys. I just thought they were out of my league, so I didn't even try. But I did Match.com a lot. Single guys were preferred, but not required. And I had a lot of first dates. But then my social justice work started causing problems with my personal life. Because nobody likes a know-it-all. Nobody likes that person, you know, the goody-two-shoes. And I got it. I mean, I really did. I mean, who wants that? Who wants the goody-two-shoes girl? And I got that it could be really intimidating when your date pulls out her sparkly pink vagina and proceeds to tell you all about the advocacy. This is a sparkly pink vagina, I swear. At least I think that's what it is. That's what they told me. So it's a little intimidating when somebody pulls it out and starts talking about the vagina monologues and being in them and, you know, working against violence against women. But to be fair, really, how many of you can say you've been on a date with a girl with a sparkly pink vagina, besides David? I mean, I thought it would be good cachet, but no. Actually, I was given this as an award. I didn't make it. And it was an award not for being in the Vagina Monologues, which I was in, down at one of the theaters downtown. Although, I should have gotten an award for incredible acting despite being incredibly drunk. Because I thought, well, we're all going to celebrate. We're going to toast our success before we go on stage. And then there's this one scene where we're supposed to all be in a bar and drinking. And I thought, let's have real wine for it. So everybody toasted, was happy. Of course, I drank a few more behind stage. And then I get behind the curtain ready to go on. And I panicked because I realized, oh, my God, I forgot my lines. And I wasn't even supposed to memorize my lines. This was supposed to be a dramatic reading, but I thought it would be even more dramatic if I memorized them and spoke them. So both my ego and my alcoholism conspired to get me. But I pulled it together, and when the spotlight came up, I was in my place, in my burqa, and I delivered my monologue. And there was a lot of screaming and yelling and applause for it. And then I, of course, hosted the after party at my house, because then I could drink like I really wanted to without having to worry about driving home and killing somebody. The award didn't come for that. It came for testifying down at the Capitol for Stop Violence Against Women Day. I got to deliver the plea to the General Assembly to change laws to protect victims of sexual assault. I made the governor and his wife cry. Even the TV reporters came up to me, were sniffling, and the one guy I had worked with before, and he said, I had no idea you were such a powerball. Well, but the thing was, I wasn't just an advocate. I am a survivor. It'll be 25 years in October since the night I was raped repeatedly and held hostage for 5 hours, and it still gets me. It still gets me. It was in 1993. I shared that story, including the part how I was locked in a mental hospital afterwards for 18 days because the doctor on call didn't believe me. He thought I just couldn't handle having gotten involved so quickly on a date, and that, you know, I was embarrassed because I liked it rough. Jackass. It took 18 days for my family to get me out of the hospital. And when they discharged me, the doctor told them that I would never again be a fully functioning, independent person, that I would need supported living and maybe a supported job. And I vowed on that day to prove him and everybody else wrong, because I couldn't get justice by the time I got out and they examined me. All that was left were the scars. The physical ones and the emotional ones. The good news is the law did get changed that year I testified, and I was asked to speak at several other rallies. I was also interviewed for a number of news stories. Then more than one guy said after meeting me on a first date, I can't go out with you. I can't deal with what you are. And what I was a survivor of a violent crime. But what he meant was that I was damaged goods. And that's how I felt. And it confirmed all my worst suspicions about myself. I heard somebody say in a meeting recently that he listens to people's stories for the flip switch. The series of events that happened in an alcoholic's life to flip the switch on their drinking from drinking a lot to full-blown alcoholism. It got me thinking, what flipped my switch? Well, in 2005, I had surgery and wore a cast on my ankle for 3 months. I feel your pain, Terry. Because I fell at work. I was not drinking at the time. The surgery went well, but it didn't recover like I was supposed to, so they wrote me off as permanently partially disabled and gave me a check and said, we're really sorry. I didn't buy that. I decided to do rehab my own way, which included, you know, drinking wine to kill the pain, and then exercising, because that would make it better. And it kind of helped. 2 months later, I was diagnosed with a blood disorder and had to go for IV treatments every week for 8 weeks, where I imagined myself having cancer like the other people in the room. It's a bit of a hypochondriac, just a little. Then Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and after watching it on the news, I got really mad and wrote a letter to the editor, which was no big deal, except it got picked up by one of those nationally syndicated hate mongers on radio, and I was personally vilified for 2 days. He had all my contact information, and I started receiving hate mail, hate calls, hate. They started harassing my employer, telling them to fire me, and then I started getting death threats. I had all these people calling, saying that I was no good, I was a traitor to my country, I should die just because of my opinion. Alcohol took away the pain, as did a new boyfriend. And it didn't matter that he already had a girlfriend. He said he was going to break up with her, so I could wait. Of course, I didn't wait. But he didn't break up with her, which got a little ugly when she started doing the drive-bys at night and the angry calls. And then it got worse. I got pregnant. He didn't want me to be pregnant. He strongly encouraged me not to stay pregnant. But he didn't have to make the decision because the doctor found out there was something wrong with the pregnancy and that I should wait a little longer to find out how bad it was going to be, but I didn't wait. After my boyfriend brought me home from having the procedure, he said he was going to a Christmas party because he couldn't handle the stress and my moodiness. And I stayed dating him for 5 years. Thank God for the alcohol. Switch flipped. That was it. I drank to numb the physical and emotional pain. I drank to erase the fear. I drank to be somebody I wasn't. Someone who didn't care what others thought of me. Someone who dealt with people day in and day out. Who was tough and organized and a leader. And didn't need anybody and didn't feel any pain. And that's who I was until I would sober up. And then I'd have to get drunk all over again. In 2007, I received another award for my advocacy for stopping violence against women. And I'm going to really try hard not to cry on this one. I went back and looked at it this week because I wanted to remember this. In presenting it, they said this. Should the meek ultimately inherit the earth, Sam Marie Engel will stand front and center as one with a quiet voice who made a big impact. Engel's work with the program where I worked has come to be seen as a model for the type of engaged student scholar Emory hopes to send forth into the world. Yet she made her greatest impact this past fall when she agreed to speak publicly at the Take Back the Night rally about the sexual assault she endured some 10 years ago, where her willingness to risk public scrutiny demonstrated her courage and altruism. Inspired by her exhortation to them to break the silence surrounding sexual violence towards women, several students came forward to share their own stories, and in doing so, began to take back not just the night, but the rest of their lives. And after that moment, sitting in my chair, after an open wine bar during the cocktail hour, open wine during dinner, everybody celebrating. When I went in to get up to get that award, I realized I was completely smashed. And there was a good chance that I wasn't going to make it up to the podium to get the award. Somehow I made it up there, I think they thought my unsteadiness and wobbliness was being emotional about the award. And then my tears coursing down my cheeks were gratitude, but in truth, it was because I felt ashamed. Not only didn't I deserve the award, I thought I was too drunk almost to get it. And you know what I thought when I made it back to my seat? Why had everyone else at the table left wine in their wine glasses, and what could I do to get that without making a complete fool of myself? And the rest of the evening, all I could pay attention to were those wine glasses and wondering what moron doesn't drink all the wine and why don't they just give them all to me? My drinking escalated, resulting in several other public embarrassments. Like, I went to some other events, big fancy affairs in huge ballrooms, and they had to call the paramedics on me twice because I couldn't breathe, which really meant I was too drunk to breathe normally. And I remember one of them is laying on the floor in the back of the ballroom while this huge CEO is getting an award and talking about all his philanthropic work in Africa and, you know, all this great stuff. And there I am, and they're trying to figure out what the heck is wrong with me. I was just smashed. They stopped inviting me after that. By then I was up to, God, it was at least 2 bottles of wine every day. Every day. I black out every night. And I didn't drink, like, the whiskey girl wine. I cared about the ABV. It had to be at least 13% ABV or I wouldn't drink in it. I mean, why waste the money on cheap wine? I mean, it came out of a box, but it was still 14% alcohol by volume. A lot of volume. The paramedics were called for me one more time. Well, on a work trip to Chicago, I was in charge of other people's children. I started drinking on the plane, just two, and I mixed them with soda so it would look, you know, fancy. Then I popped a Xanax because I was feeling anxious. We went and did some work. Then we decided we would stop for a drink on the way back to the hotel. We went to dinner, had several more drinks. After dinner, I don't think I ate dinner. I think I drank it. Then we went back to the hotel, had some more, and once again, I couldn't breathe. So this time, I got an ambulance trip to the ER, but because I didn't look like an alcoholic, nobody checked my blood alcohol volume. I really wish they had. All they did was give me an IV and oxygen, and then they sent me back with my coworker. Who didn't really talk to me in the taxi ride back. I was her boss. I was responsible for her, and she was hauling me in and out of the ER. I vowed I wasn't going to drink anymore, and I didn't on that trip. That night, I was really sick in my hotel room, and I had a surgery the year before because the sphincter that connects the esophagus and the stomach stopped working. That happens if you drink a lot. The thing, it just quit. So they had to create a new one by taking a portion of my stomach and tying it around my esophagus, which meant it's anatomically impossible for me to throw up. I can't do it. And I spent that night in my hotel room retching and retching and retching. All they came up with some blood. I could have ruptured something. I probably had alcohol poisoning. And the fact that I didn't die, I can only credit to God. You would think that was the bottom. But I drank for 2 more years after that. I stopped showing up for work. I started working from home, you know, because I was sick. I gave up all of my activities, all of my volunteer work, boyfriend, everything. All I did was drink. And then my mom was admitted to the hospital for her own addiction. She wasn't an alcoholic, but she was an addict. It doesn't matter what her drug of choice was, but by then it had fried her lungs. She had end-stage emphysema, cancer in her lungs and in her liver, and an infection was eating up her legs. The beautiful thing is we got to talk before she lapsed into her final coma. And she apologized and said she did love me and did approve of me and thought she was doing the right thing by trying to direct my life. She also apologized for choosing her drug over us. My father and I were holding my mother's hands when she slipped the bonds of earth. It wasn't peaceful, and it wasn't pretty. And over my mom's just dead body, my father looked at me and said, "Hon, I want you to promise me one thing. When you go home tonight, don't drink." And no one had ever said to me before in my family anything about my alcohol. I thought they didn't know. I thought I had snuck it past them. Of course, I went home and drank because my mom just died. But it made me realize that that was going to happen to me very soon if I didn't stop. The end came on March 19th after a holiday weekend, St. Patrick's Day, spent in a drunken haze. I have no idea what I did or how I did it. I just woke up that Monday and thought, I can't do this anymore. I couldn't walk in a straight line. My hands shook all the time. I thought I had Parkinson's disease and I actually wished I had Parkinson's disease because that would have been better than alcoholism. But I was just an alcoholic. The next morning I received a call from the Employee Assistance Program because I had called them after my mom died to ask for some bereavement help. And the same woman I had called me and said, "Do you remember talking to me last week?" I said, "No." "Well, we were supposed to have a meet at 2 o'clock last Thursday, and when you didn't show up, I called you. And when I called you, you didn't make a lot of sense on the phone. And then you stopped talking. I waited 5 minutes, and you never said a word." I was like, I don't remember that. She said, "And then the next day, I got a call from your boss saying similar behavior had happened on a conference call a few days before with your coworkers." And she's like, "I think you have an alcohol problem." I said, "I do too." I went to rehab because I thought if you went to rehab, you didn't have to go to AA. And that wasn't true. They put me in the young adults group in rehab. I thought it was because the other group was too full, but it turned out I read the stuff they sent to the insurance company to justify why I had to stay there for 2.5 months, and it said, "She's incredibly immature." So I was in with my peer group. I was 40-something years old with the maturity level of a 21-year-old alcoholic. Yay me. It was awesome. They told me that weekend I had to go to a meeting every day and I had to get rid of everything in my house that had to do with alcohol. And I argued with them because, you know, some of those glasses were hand-blown artisan things that I'd gotten at the arts festival and they should stay because they're really a work of art. And then one of the other guys in the group says, "Oh my God, this bong is a work of art. I can't possibly get rid of it." Fine, okay, whatever. But I brought it up at the first AA meeting I went to, which was here. It was the Saturday newcomers meeting. I don't know who was there, but it looked like a circus. They were the strangest people I had ever seen. And they were laughing and talking about drinking and being sober, which was way better than drinking. And I thought they were insane. And I talked about myself in between sobs and said, "They made me get rid of all of my wine stuff, but I still have these glasses that I can't get rid of." And this lady, she's like, I know we're not supposed to crosstalk, but honey, really, are those glasses worth dying over?" What? Okay, so I put everything on my dining room table. some of you have heard this before, I had all the broken wine glasses, the artisan wine glasses, the beer pint glasses that I had gotten from all my alcoholism, the 50 coasters, the 300 wine corks that I had kept because I was going to make a cork board out of them. I found 200 more after I got rid of those. Like, where did these things come from? I got rid of the Cabernet steak sauce, the bourbon barbecue sauce, and I didn't even eat steak. And the Merlot lip balm. They actually make lip balm that's made out of Merlot wine. They made me get rid of that. You might be an alcoholic if you have Merlot-flavored lip balm. Maybe. And when I saw it all there, I realized, oh my God, alcohol has infiltrated every part of my life. It was everywhere. And these were all the things that I had used to trick myself into saying, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a wine connoisseur or a craft beer drinker. I was a complete alcoholic. And I am so glad that it turned out I was an alcoholic. Here, I finally found the answers to... I finally figured out how to live. I got a temporary sponsor and then a real sponsor. I worked the steps, every single one of them. A lot. I still work them. I mean, I've done maybe, 25 steps? I'll probably have to do one tomorrow. I see my sponsor nodding, yes, probably. Crap. I stayed in rehab for 2.5 months and then voluntarily signed myself up for 6 months of weekly aftercare along with random drug and alcohol screens that I had to pay for because I really wanted to be sober. I wanted what you guys had. I went to one meeting, sometimes two meetings every day for 9 months except for the 3 days when I had to have surgery for the elbow I had trashed falling on it so many times when I was drinking. And it turns out I've had 4 surgeries since I've gotten sober in 6 years. And the cool thing is I got through each of those without relapsing, without becoming an addict on painkillers, because I had a program. I was accountable. I took medicine the way I was supposed to. People watched me. I went to meetings. I talked to my sponsor. She took me for one of those surgeries and laughed at me for months because I sounded like a complete idiot when I came out of the anesthesia. She's like, oh my God, that was the best thing I've ever seen. I was so mad at her, I thought of firing her as a sponsor because that was offensive. I am my need. You laughed at me. She's still laughing at me. But that was awesome because I really needed to learn Rule 62. Stop taking yourself so damn seriously. I lost my job, which was awesome. Actually, they invited me not to return because they said, we can't fire you, but we invite you not to come back because nobody wants to work with you. And if you leave, don't have any contact with them ever. Nobody wants to talk to you. I was devastated, but it turned out to be awesome that they did that because I had to face, I couldn't hide it. This is what I had done. And I whined and complained at work all the time. Would come in, if there was a problem with me, everybody knew about it. A lot. And I was the boss. These people had to listen to me whine and complain and whip everybody into a frenzy before I got drunk and stopped showing up for work. I put them through hell. They had every right to say, please don't talk to us anymore. I mean, I disrespected them. I was offensive. I was everything but a coworker and a boss. It meant that I couldn't make direct amends to them. So my sponsor said, but step, it says make them, except when to do so would injure them or others. Yeah, don't talk to them. You're going to hurt them. But it asks us to be willing to make amends. So I wrote out all the amends and I said them to her. and said, I'll be ready if I ever see them, if God ever presents the opportunity, I'll be ready to make amends. And God presented me the opportunity for one. I was able to make amends to him because he left the organization, contacted me, and he said, you have nothing to apologize for. I'm just glad you didn't die. And since then, since I couldn't make amends for, and I couldn't pay back the thousands of dollars I stole from my employer by, you know, not showing up for work, but taking a paycheck, I have worked pro bono secretly for them for four years. I'm a writer. That's my job now. That's what I always wanted to be, but I was too afraid to be that because my mom said it was stupid, and I had decided I was going to do whatever she said I should do. I turned my will and my life over to her and everybody else, and I abdicated responsibility for everything. It was my choice. I did all of that. It wasn't her fault. It wasn't my father's fault for not rescuing me. I did all of it. And I could do differently. I was able to see all the patterns, see that all the bad boyfriends were my choices. You know, I chose to be a victim. I chose to not have anything stick because I really didn't want to make anything stick. But working all the steps, I learned that I'm not damaged goods. Validation comes not from those external things. Validation comes from my higher power, who I choose to call God. If I am using the gifts and what I'm supposed to be doing in doing the work that God wants me to do, that's all that God asks of me. No one can make me worthy or worthless. That's an inside job. I make a living. I don't make trouble. I don't do things to get attention. My largest client today is the organization that invited me not to come back 6 years ago. It's a different unit, but they welcomed me back. And most of my work is done anonymously. There's no name on it, but I do a good job. And I finally become worthy of being somebody's partner, worthy of being a wife. My sponsor picked out my husband. She said, you should date David. He's perfect for you. And I argued with her. I picked all kinds of bad other people. It was embarrassing. It was stupid. And then I put myself on a dating moratorium, and I know we're almost out of time. So, but then she finally said, just give the poor man a chance. And we'd been friends for a couple of years. We hung out in the same recovery circle. And, you know, my sponsor was right again. God made the perfect partner for me and David. And in recovery, he's made both of us worthy of each other. We've been together 4 years now this week. Two of them is husband and wife. We got married. And it's been such a blessing. It's a blessing to be somebody who's worthy of love and who's capable of giving love and who is, you know, and I meant every vow, including the forsaking all others part. There's nobody better for me than David. Quick word about service and literature. Do anything everybody tells you when you get sober? I did. Intergroup rep, co-treasurer. David and I now, we take care of the literature cabinet back there. Literature has been huge in my recovery, which is why I brought this bag full of all the books that have helped me get and stay sober. In addition to the usual suspects, I just had a bit, Drop the Rock, you have to do it. Forming True Partnerships, grapevine stories about how people, you know, are friends, coworkers, wives, awesome. And my latest one that I'm reading, Sex in Recovery. If you have problems with sex, this is an awesome book. It teaches, like, why am I such a fruitcake? It doesn't teach you how to have sex. It just teaches you, you know, how not to be a whack job like me. We sell them in the back in the literature cabinet. Not all of them are conference approved, but they're either from AA, Grapevine, or Hazelton. And I highly recommend all of them. Of myself, I am nothing. My Father doeth the works. All that I have, all that I am, all that I might be are God's gift. Life is not easy, but it's beautiful. We may arrive here broken, but we can heal. I am not damaged goods, and neither are you. None of you. We are children of a higher power. Children worthy of love and forgiveness. You and I deserve to be sober, to live sober. We don't deserve to suffer anymore. If I can be redeemed, you can too. No other person can get me sober, and no other person can take away my sobriety. But there is one who has all power and is ready and eager to help us. All we have to do is surrender. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam, for your amazing story. Can we get a volunteer to give out the regular chips?
I'll do it.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Run through the chips, white chip. Somebody, I'm going to give it 24 hours, not take a drink for 24 hours. Anybody coming in or coming back, want a white chip. All right.
Running so